For my latest nostalgia interview, it was such a pleasure to interview William Rowlandson, who is a senior lecturer in Hispanic Studies at the University of Kent. And William talks about growing up in the West Country. We find out what the roots are of his love for teaching. William talks about a binding thread which runs throughout our lives, which starts at school, goes right through to retirement. We find out that William is very passionate about a lot of things. He prefers to see himself not as a lecturer, but as a facilitator who is able to elicit from students what it is that, as it were, floats their boat. We find out about Sartre and Graham Greene and the impact that 49p Penguin books that were sold in a bookshop near his school had a particular influence on him. He talks about The Doors, Led Zeppelin, Orbital, and how the Beatles have played a seminal role in family road trips. And then, this was an interesting interview because I thought I was getting towards the end and I had just one more question to ask William, but suddenly the interview went off in a completely different direction. You'll find out exactly how it went, and it's a very intriguing interview as a result. But William Rowlandson is my guest this week. Welcome to the latest in my series of interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. I am with William Rowlandson, and we were just talking, William, that you came to Kent the year after me, so we're both veterans of this place. Is it 2005 in your case?
Yeah, we're the old greybeards.
Yeah, well, I feel that way. There was a time when I came here when people said, gosh, he's the new boy, so you know, we'll give him lots of work, and then suddenly now it's like, Chris will know all the answers, and I think in your case...
So they still give you lots of work.
Yeah, I still have the same word. Nothing's changed. The hierarchy hasn't changed. It's just the fact that I get called on for my wealth of experience. But anyway, good to chat with you. Fill me in a little bit on your own background. So you've been here like me for about 13, 14 years, but tell me something about where you're from, where you grew up.
Well, it's funny, when people ask, if you go to Spain, for example, if you meet a Spanish person, you say, where are you from? And the answer is always really clear, because people tend to travel around Spain, families tend to move around less than you do in Britain, for example, and people go to the university in their own town. So if you say, where are you from? Ah, from Madrid. Whereas very often you ask somebody who's British, you say, where are you from? They go, well, you know, my dad was from the north of England, my mum was from somewhere else, and that's sort of my case as well. I was born and brought up in the West Country, in Salisbury Plain, in a little village called Tilshead, not far from Stonehenge. And in fact, maybe later when we're talking about nostalgia, it's inevitable that I'll bring to the table questions about megalithic sites and Stonehenge and the ancient landscape. And I went to university down in Exeter, so I stayed in the West Country. And then I did my master's and my PhD, and including getting my first work in teaching in university, in Exeter. So generally, if people ask me where I'm from, if I'm in Spain and people ask me where I'm from, I say I'm from the southwest of England. And that's the kind of the easiest answer I can give.
I'm very conscious that when people ask me, where are you from, I do the thing that I thought was an absolute anathema when I was living in Cardiff or Lampeter, where I did my degree, because I'll now say I'm Welsh, I'm from Wales. Whereas somebody who's from London will often say they're from, and they'll mention the part of London, they're from Hammersmith, or they're from... and... What strikes me is that Wales was often sort of just seen as this sort of, well, it's all the same. It couldn't be more different. North and south, you know, east and west. Look at the way we had the vote in 97 on devolution. Different parts of Wales voted very differently in terms of, you know, particularly where there was a prominence of Welsh speaking. And so those generic constructs. But I feel more Welsh now that I'm in Canterbury, because there's a part of me that thinks that when I was in Wales, I never sounded Welsh. I didn't feel that I completely fitted in. But that's my inheritance. And if I have a student who's Welsh, or I pick up a slight Welsh accent, I feel nostalgic, but often I'll, you know, Tipyn Bach y Gymraeg, which means a little bit of Welsh. I can't speak much more Welsh than that, but I feel that all those things that I learnt when I was 11 and thought, you know, my family don't speak Welsh, we're all English speaking, sort of has a place. And I feel a very strong association with my own roots.
I think that's probably quite standard with lots of people, that they will have a childhood location as a bit of a hallowed place in their minds, you know, a place that maybe they'll return to when they're done with the daily toil. And it could be a place that they went on holiday, or it could be a place where they were born, or it could be a place where they went to school. But I imagine, and again, putting it in the Spanish perspective, a lot of people in the cities in Spain have family from what's called El Pueblo. And El Pueblo can be anything from a tiny sort of hamlet to a town that is probably the size of Canterbury, and that's El Pueblo. And you'll find in a lot of fiction, a lot of films, the idea of returning to El Pueblo once you're retired, once you're done with the day-to-day. It's that sort of, it's that place that you... where everything's easier, when, you know, you can sit back and relax and the landscape is more beautiful and you know the people in your neighbourhood and all those other slightly mythologised ideas. Now, I still have that. When I moved to Kent in 2005, I did have that idea that, I consider myself not from here because I wasn't. And I always had this idea, for a number of years I had this idea, I'll return to the West Country, that's kind of where my roots are, that's where I'm from. But what's interesting is, over the years that I've worked here, I've lived in the same house now for a number of years, my kids are at school, my eldest kid is soon to start at Langton Girls, so she's nearly 11, and my youngest kid is soon to be 8, they are very much from here. They're absolutely from here. They're born and bred Kentish, despite the fact that I'm from the West Country with my different ancestral roots, and their mother, my wife, is from the north of Spain. I sort of think, of course, I do belong here. I am from here. And it's quite a lovely feeling, actually. It's quite a nice feeling to think, yeah, you can put your roots down wherever you want, really. Reminds me of a little line by the poet Gary Snyder, who's one of my favourite writers of the Beat Generation. And he said just a simple maxim, find a place and dig in. And that was it. Find a place, dig in. I like that.
And I find as well that in terms of reconnecting with people that I used to know when I was at school, it's the people rather than the environment that make a crucial difference. You can reconnect with those people on social media and you find that you've got the same passions, the same interests, the same hobbies, the same spark that made you want to be friends with them in the first place. But the actual physical environment, going back to that environment, as I will be doing at my university reunion in July, I feel very conflicted about that because in a way it's returning to a place that I've now outgrown. And I'm doing very different things in my life now. And I think it's the combination of the people and the place, memories that are very, well, bittersweet, to coin a very obvious sort of nostalgia-oriented phrase.
Quite, yeah, of course. I mean, things change. I could no more go and live in Salisbury Plain than I could go and live in the centre of London. I wouldn't like to. And yet, driving through Salisbury Plain, stopping and going for walks on Salisbury Plain, visiting a couple of friends I have on Salisbury Plain is a truly wonderful experience. But that's not the same as sort of wishing I was still there. So again, there is this curious tension between this sense of longing for a place set against the actual practicalities of, okay, would you want to live there? No, I don't mean I want to live there. I just mean that it's a place that I hold this sort of this nostalgia for. But it's not quite the same as actually wanting to go and live there, of course.
No, and I find that even in my career, I'm returning to some of the passions that I had when I was young, which I kind of kept in a drawer to some extent, because when I came here in 2004, I thought that some of my interests were a little bit eccentric, or they were seen to be in terms of I was in my early 30s, I was working with colleagues who were in their 60s. So when I was asked questions like, what music do you like listening to? I was conscious that one colleague would say that he would listen to Brahms and he'd go to concerts, and I was thinking, you know, I listen to Radio 2 and I'm sort of interested in, I'd listen to Pick of the Pops every Saturday. So I kept a lot of that under wraps, but then did find in later years that actually the way that I speak, the way I lecture, is certainly modelled on or influenced by some of those radio and TV presenters, newsreaders, DJs, anything from when I was younger, because it was their performance style that captivated me, that made me want to tune into the radio every afternoon at a certain time. And some of those quizzes that they would do of an afternoon, you know, part of me thinks that in a teaching context, sometimes we can the best moments are when you're slightly off your guard, and people can actually feel maybe a little bit of a competitive streak. It's all those sort of things which are not the way academia is conventionally done. You know, you stand up and deliver and then you leave the room. I've been in situations where somebody very senior will give a paper and then close their booklet afterwards and literally walk out of the room. No chance for questions. It's literally job done. I speak, you listen. That's a very authoritarian model, which actually mirrors a lot of my own interests in theology, the sort of the Karl Barth model of doing things. I think the university culture has changed very much.
And I do as well.
Do you find in that sense that you are able to bring some of those childhood memories and passions and interests to bear on what you're doing now all those decades?
Absolutely. I have this feeling. I'm quite clear about this in my mind, that all research, and by that I mean all research for teaching, because research and research for teaching is all the same thing. Research is research. All research is a form of self-evaluation. That's to say, for example, you're a second-year student comes to see you to talk about their plans, their project for a 15-credit dissertation. What you want to be eliciting from that student is what really floats their boat, what really gets them excited and impassioned and sort of keeps them awake at night. What are the things, you know, you're about to go and spend 3 months or 2.5 months studying something. What is it that you really want to do? And it's a very obvious thing, but sometimes it's perhaps slightly overlooked because of this, what I consider to be a rather false notion of objectivity. I don't believe there's anything that's objective, and I think this is what postmodernism demonstrated, what modernism demonstrated in the wake of sort of 19th century realism. Everything is subjective. It doesn't mean that you don't have objectivity within that. It means that I don't think that the field of research is ever radically divorced from the person doing that research. Therefore, back to your case, and I would say the same for me, and I'd say the same for everyone, that by the end of your career, you'll look back and look at all the things you've published and all the things you've taught and all the conversations you've had and all the presentations and all the seminars and all the conferences, and you'll realise it does conform to a particular narrative, and it does actually, you'll realise that, I think we'll all realise, we're actually looking at similar things, where there's something that will hold, that there'll be some sort of binding thread throughout all this work. And that work will have started years and years and years before, well before you started working in the university. It will have started when you were at school. It will have started when you were very young. The types of interest that you had back then were first awakened and are then pursued throughout the rest of your life. I find that a wonderful idea. And I hope to tap into it with the work that I do. And I hope to help people tap into it when they're studying even just an essay for their module, or even just coming to a seminar. You know, let's try and find the connection with the individuals here. Let's try and present this material and discuss this material in a way which is relevant to us all. Now, I have a few friends who've worked as note takers in the university, working for student support. And I've heard some quite alarming stories, and I'm not going to mention any names, I'm not even going to mention any departments or schools or faculties, but lectures in particular, where the lecturer has, exactly as described, come in demonstrating very little of what they are as a human being, i.e. they're sort of, they come in holding their notes, they don't really address people, they don't look at people. And also there are many, many people in the lecture theatre. They talk, generally reading notes and generally with an overburdened PowerPoint, with lots of facts, lots of stats, lots of graphs and figures, and then they leave. Now, that to me is a betrayal of everything that the whole of the education system, whether it's primary through to tertiary, is based on. That to me is, you may as well have just read a boring article. And in fact, in that sort of circumstance, I imagine that the students only turn up because A, they have to for the registry, and B, because they need to know exactly what was said, because they need to then regurgitate that for the essay. Now, fortunately, I don't see that in amongst any of my colleagues, and I participate in lots of other programs and lots of other disciplines and lots of other modules, and I don't see that, especially not in SECL. But I do know that it's there through these anecdotes from some of my friends who've worked as note takers. That to me is when the individual, you'd be puzzling over who is that individual, what floats their boat, what drives them forward, why are they revealing so little about themselves, what are they, in a way, what where's this defence mechanism coming from? I find that a curious one.
Yes, I've always found the lecture experience intensely autobiographical, in a way that if a student was to write an essay in which they were to sort of go off subject, then obviously that would not be something that we would recommend, in the same way that if a student was to write an essay on a particular theorist and they spend the first paragraph saying which school they went to, where they were born, we'd say, you know, we want to know what it is about that person conceptually, you know, that is so fascinating, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of the question that we're asking. But I have to say that I cannot divorce the personal, the autobiographical, from the academic when I'm teaching, because if I've got 30 or 40 people in a room, the question is, you know, why are they here? Why am I here? What is that point of connection? I could just read something out. That would be straightforward. But I don't want to do that, and I don't think the students want to do that. I've often joked with the students that I've been at talks where I've been sitting where they are, and I'm thinking, I have to endure this for the next 2 hours. But when I'm teaching, I feel so alive and so vibrant, I like to think that some of that enthusiasm will rub off on the students. Because when I say this, sometimes the response is very muted, and I'm thinking, well, you know, maybe it's just me. But for what is the point? What is the point of waking up in the morning, coming into work? What is the motivation? What is the thread? And actually, partly these nostalgia interviews are part of, for me, reconnecting with that of what is it that used to make me very excited? What are the structures that I had in childhood that I wanted to bring into, you know, adulthood? I mean, I certainly, and I'll ask you in a minute about, you know, what made you come into academia, but I certainly didn't expect or envisage a career in academia. No one in my family before my sister, who's 3 years older than me, went to university. So it was a completely different path, but one that once I was set on, that came to define me. But now that I'm within this profession, I kind of feel I can bring some of those quirks, those eccentricities, and I'm only comfortable when I'm doing that. Otherwise, it does feel that I'm doing something corporate and inauthentic.
As a nice parallel there with Borges, I've spent many, many years. In fact, here's another, going back to our previous comment. I first started reading Borges when I was about 15, and he's basically accompanied me ever since as a guide, as a fairly tricky teacher who slaps you in the face from time to time. One of the things that he demonstrated as a teacher, and I think he's a very wise teacher, he used to teach literature. In particular, he used to have a great passion for English literature, including going back to Anglo-Saxon literature, is he would never try. He actually said so in one of his interviews. He said, "I don't believe in forced reading. Forced reading is rather like forced love." He says, "What I can do is demonstrate to people my passion and my love for the text that we're studying. And if that then unlocks their passion, then so much for the best. But if it doesn't, then no problem." And he has this wonderful line. He says, if you're not enjoying a book, then it's because the book wasn't written for you. Lay it aside and start another. And I think that's such wise advice. But again, he was, especially in his later years when he was blind, he would deliver these amazing lectures. For example, a lecture on Dante's Divine Comedy, or a lecture on Emanuel Swedenborg, or a lecture on the Transcendentalists, in particular Emerson, without any notes, because he couldn't read them, from memory, generally sort of looking into the near distance, because his eyes were, you know, he couldn't really focus on people in front of him. And with these long passages that he was reciting from memory, accurately as well, I mean, people have sort of checked to see how accurate he was. He was very accurate. And what you have there is In fact, my reading of Swedenborg, I can thank Borges for the fact that I've been reading Swedenborg for over a decade, precisely because I was infused with his enthusiasm for Swedenborg. So I thought, well, if he's so excited by this writer, well, maybe it's worth reading. And in the same way that people have attributed the to particularly to Borges, for example, a more widespread interest in Robert Louis Stevenson as a serious writer as opposed to just a writer of children's stories, and in Chesterton and in Emerson and in all sorts of people that Borges was really passionate about and sort of brought in from the shadows to a certain degree. And again, so what the point there is, he's not teaching anyone the book. He's not teaching anyone, he's not instructing anyone on how to enjoy that particular book or that particular writer. He's reading and demonstrating his own passion. I find that to be very compelling and very beautiful.
Yeah, and sometimes we use the language of impact, but it's more about how your work can be disseminated in a wider sphere. But for me, the question is, what is the motivation? What is the thing that makes that person want to embark on that project in the first place? Are they doing it out of a sense of personal achievement, or is there something? It's like the Orson Welles Rosebud. You know, there's something from childhood that is that they can't escape from, whether they acknowledge, you know, whether it's subliminal or subconscious or not. And I find that here, that sometimes we have various targets that we have to perform. The ref is an obvious one, and for me, that's the equivalent of going to a film festival where I'm told you have to watch these four films. And I think, I have to watch four films today, that's a lot. Whereas if I'm at a film festival and they say, you can do what you like, I would probably see six films in one day. But because I'm told I have to watch four, I kind of feel that there's a requirement on me, an imposition. Whereas given the choice, I will go the extra mile. I used to find that with my PhD supervision. My PhD supervisor wouldn't be saying, Chris, I want 3,000 words by next Friday. But I would write it anyway, because that was what I felt I needed to do. So that maybe it makes me atypical. But what it does, there's a sense of drive, which is coming from somewhere. And I think I'm still trying to work out where that's coming from. Is it always that sense of wanting to almost to prove to some authority? Is it a parent? Is it a school teacher? Is it completely within? Is it that sense of saying, look at me, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be, so, you know, don't fire me. Keep me in a job, please. But that sense of purpose, if you don't know why somebody is embarking on a project and they're telling you have to achieve this particular objective, then quite honestly, that objective to me seems contrived, artificial, and actually quite a burden.
It's a subtle game, though. It's a difficult one to judge, because I've marked, as you probably have, some essays and dissertations coming from universities in the States. And a couple that I've read have an addendum, a sort of an appendix, which is, so, who am I? And a kind of an autobiographical section. And it's a little bit, I've read a couple which are a bit nauseating, actually. And in the same way that if everyone giving a conference talk had a 10-minute session to talk about their own personal trajectory, it would be overburdening. It would be a nightmare. So what you want to see, and what I hope, when it works, it's absolutely beautiful, is when you can hear the voice of the person, of the writer, or the person giving a talk, or the person giving a seminar, or a lecture, or whatever it is. You can feel that personal relationship. You can almost start to sort of intuit that narrative without it being presented as a particular line, which could be a bit of a distraction. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's something that you want to be sort of...
Oh, it has to be interwoven.
Interwoven, yeah. Subtly and constructively, and in a way which sort of animates the text, as opposed to being a sort of something like pinned on to the end.
Oh, no, absolutely. Because if somebody was to say, let me tell you why I'm interested in this. No, but the enthusiasm should come, the passion should come from their narrative. Like a good essay, you might say to a student, don't put too much biographical details about the author, the theorist that you're working on. But if the student can incorporate that material, that factual information, into their narrative about what it is about that figure and their history, their thought, their conceptualizations that is important, then that's different. It's how they use it, how they incorporate it, rather than the sort of bracketing it out that, you know, everything goes into a particular box. I mean, like when we mark an essay, you look at the overall picture, you're not less, you know, it'd be very frustrating if you were to say, well, I'll give a maximum of 10 marks for this, 10 marks for the syntax, 10 marks for the original ideas, 10 for the knowledge, 10 for the understanding. So, and that will work in a different context, maybe in a more school-type environment. That is necessary because you're learning those skills or acquiring those skills from a pupil as they're growing up. But at university, it's a different set of skills. So it's the holistic picture that I think matters. Mm. But that, in terms of that wider vision, I think would be a good word, that must come out of the way that somebody channels their enthusiasm. And you also know if it's real. I get that from the radio. I will, and particularly if it's live radio, if something is recorded, I'm not interested because I know that what's going out, it may not be bland, but it's being vetted. Although, of course, that was the thing with Jonathan Ross all those years ago and Russell Brand. It was pre-recorded, but it was allowed to go out, and the BBC then, you know, made sure that they put their foot firmly down on, you know, ironically, for anything that's pre-recorded, there has to be somebody listening and vetting it and, you know, ticking all the boxes. But something that's live, when anything can go wrong, you know, then obviously that same mechanism isn't in place. But, you know, if you feel that the person is there, if they're just doing their job, I really don't care. If they're just doing it because they want the money or because it's the fame or the adulation, or they haven't got the talent, it's not there. But you know authentically when somebody has... you know, it's the real deal, which actually for me is why a lot of those, when there's some of those people in radio who in later years were exposed as paedophiles or, you know, there were sort of sex crimes, sometimes you thought, oh, that's my whole childhood gone because I really trusted that person. You know, I grew up writing to Jimmy Savile. It's like, oh, that's all that, although in Jimmy Savile's case, he was a bit of an enigma anyway, so he wasn't on that list of people to look up to. But that is important because you ally yourself. You know, sometimes you walk into a room and there's the sense of who do you identify with most? Who do you gravitate towards? And I don't know if you have those same sort of markers.
In terms of teaching?
Anything.
Well, yes. I mean, one gravitates towards the people one vibrates with. I mean, I think that would occur in any situation, and it has since people first make friends in junior school.
Although, in some cases, people might gravitate to somebody who's got the you know, the fastest car or the biggest wallet. That's what I mean. And sometimes, and I struggle to this day, actually, even in relationships. Sometimes, you know, what are people's motivations? You know, why is that person interested in me? You know, is it because they really want you, or is it because they, you know, can see, you know, that they might emulate you, they might see you as some sort of role model, so they can achieve a particular goal. Once that goal is met or half met, they might say, no, thank you,
well,
you know,
it's
done
those,
that, move
it's
on.
All those things, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, we're a bundle of different factors. Every single one of us has such a complexity of forces at work that if you try to isolate a particular reason for a relationship, you'd be on rocky ground. Mm. There are lots and lots of reasons, and there are sometimes when you do need, you know, sometimes it's useful to have a friend who's big and help and muscly because he can help you move your washing machine. Sometimes it's useful to have a friend who's, you know, good at translating so you can ask him to help you or her to, you see what I mean? I mean, there are all sorts of different reasons why we have different relationships at different times with different people. So I think that's something that you find,
and it's also something that you acquire, and of course it's strategic, but also sometimes you just kind of you know that you're not exploiting somebody, but you know that it works both ways, that sometimes, you know, if somebody calls on me because I have a particular skill I can help them with, I actually think this is wonderful because I can utilize a skill in a way that is helping somebody else. Rather, I mean, the idea of, like, I mean, sometimes writing references can be a bit of a burden because sometimes, you know, a student graduated 5 years early, you have to really dig up a lot of data to sort of do that. If you didn't know the student very well, you know, it can be a bit of a trial. But actually, in other respects, if you are really helping somebody get a job and you think that they've got a set of skills that, you know, mean that they've got something to offer the world, then actually it is such a pleasure to do that. And actually, it's a real privilege to be invited.
I agree. And this, Chris, is you know, this is why, despite shifting work-life balances and difficult situations for a number of people who work in teaching throughout the whole system, whether it's working in infant or nurseries, right the way through up to working in universities, or like people who work in health, is ultimately they are in that job because they are passionate about the work they're doing. And as a result, if somebody asks them their advice about a particular, in my case, a particular author, or a particular, you know, in your case, perhaps talking about a film, you wouldn't withhold your discussion. You wouldn't say, well, I'm not going to tell you because this is, you know, there has to be some sort of value on this and I need to know what the value is before I can pass. No, not at all. You talk and you're delighted to talk. You're delighted to hold that conversation. And if somebody took up more of your time because they're interested in the things that you're talking about and you're interested in them, well, there's no limit to that. And that's, of course, what is at the heart of, I mean, we're talking universities because that's where we work. It's at the heart of university. What drives the place? What drives a place is people's passion for it. Because if they didn't have the passion, then they wouldn't be here. And that's something that I thrive on here, and I love it. I mean, just like our conversation now, but all the conversations I have with all my colleagues here, in whatever discipline they work in whatever area of the university, it's there. It's tapping into the thing that they, you know, that they get enthused about, that they're bubbling about, they're really excited to talk about. And clearly, if those are things which I find also animating and exciting, then that's precisely what, that's at the basis of it all. I love that. I absolutely love that.
Is this a path that you expected to take? Was academia a goal that you had from an early age? Was there anything else that you once thought you might find yourself doing? Did you stumble across this profession?
I think for a long time I'd thought I was going to be a teacher. And in fact, when I was an undergraduate on my year abroad in Spain, I worked as an English language teacher and I absolutely loved it. And I think I've always enjoyed those kind of group dynamics of being both student and teacher. And in fact, I've always loved when the dynamics are slightly mixed as well, which is what, again, one of the, back to the sort of lecture theatre scenario, which I'm never that comfortable with because I feel that there's too much of a division. But I love small group seminars, talking in a group where actually, if there's a hierarchy, it's a very, very shallow hierarchy. And I consider myself more of as a sort of facilitator than a lecturer. I have a little bit of a problem with that word lecturer because it does imply that all you do is go around the place lecturing. I hope I don't lecture at all, really. I hope that I sort of discuss and
facilitate.
Facilitate and dialogue and engage and have conversations with rather than this idea of lecture. Anyway, I go back a long time and I've always enjoyed sort of group learning, let's say. Sharing ideas, reading something, being enthused by it and then wanting to share it. And it's at times like that when I just realise this job is perfect and wonderful. You know, this, I'm in my absolute, as I say in Spanish, estoy en mi salsa, I'm in my sauce, I'm in my element. When I read a text that dazzles me, and not only does it dazzle me, but then I get extra dazzled knowing that next week I'm going to be discussing this text with a group of people. How brilliant is that? You know, if I weren't working in a university, I'd be holding book clubs. I'd be studying with other groups. I mean, I love that group activity. I did when I was very young. I mean, at school, we used to have reading groups. We had a creative writing group. I used to gather with my friends and we'd talk about books. It sounds a bit sort of romantic, a vision. But no, we did. We would read texts and get together and discuss the text, whether it was an informal setting, going for a walk across the field, or whether it was in a slightly more organised setting as a sort of an extracurricular activity. I loved it, absolutely loved it. And I still do, I really do. So I think that actually the stirrings towards becoming a teacher, and in particular working at in the university environment, I think they were there from a very, very young age.
I remember teaching a module called Death of God a few years ago, and I think we were looking at existentialism, and I suddenly stopped. And we were literally looking at life and death questions, and the students were just sort of making notes or looking at the clock. And And I stopped and I just said, you know, obviously you're doing this module, and, you know, it was quite clear from some of the student interactions that they were here because they want the credits. But, you know, what I wanted to know is, do you wake up at 3 a.m. and are challenged by these? In other words, are you studying this because you're going to get a degree out of it, or, you know, a set of skills that you need? You have an agenda, which is perfectly fine to have. But, you know, are these, you know, we're studying existentialism, but for you, are you being challenged existentially? And no one answered. But then 2 days later, a student who actually now is doing a PhD in Durham said, you know, nobody else answered, so I didn't feel comfortable doing so. But she said, I was one of those people. I wake up at 3 a.m. and this is the stuff that challenges me. And I thought, yeah, that's all I needed, just that one student, just to know that it's not just me. And I thought that at least somebody who hears some of those eccentricities that I and it matters, and it's more than just simply I'm doing this and then we'll forget it once I've written the essay, because I'm only here because, you know, for whatever reason.
I'll give you an example of that, Chris. I a few months ago, I finished a book about Sartre. In particular, it's called Sartre in Cuba. I published it. And I didn't go into any depth about my own history with Sartre in the book, although hopefully, as we were talking earlier, hopefully my enthusiasm is sort of present throughout. I read Sartre as a GCSE student studying French, and one of the texts, I don't think students would read it now, was Reclos, the play of the three people trapped in hell. And it utterly shook me to my core. And it really, really did. I, exactly as you said, I had sleepless nights. I puzzled over this play. I was upset by it. I was intrigued by it. And straight on the heels of that, I went and read Nausea. And also, I remember going to my school library and read. There were two books about Sartre. And I read an explanatory chapter about what existentialism is, and reading about these strange terms that he uses of être en soi and être pour soi, and bad faith and contingency and all these different expressions which are present throughout Sartre's work. And I was utterly astonished by this, and it really made a big impact, and that impact has never lessened. I've had a lot of problems with Sartre. I find some of his more bullish texts quite problematic and quite difficult, and you know, I certainly take him to task. I don't hold him as a great hero, although I do think there's a heroic aspect to Sartre. But the thing that I realised as I was working on this book over the last couple of years, one of the things I realised was that I was, the voice that was writing that book was coming from all the way back from when I was a 15-16 year old. I was still puzzling over some of these really interesting, and they are absolutely life and death matters, because that's what he's writing about. Even when he's bringing it down to a political situation such as the Cuban Revolution, he's still, and this is something that I go into in the book, he's still drawing on these very, very heavy philosophical ideas about freedom, about bondage, about power, about the means by which a political system can deny the freedom of somebody. And so it goes on. And so again, linking it with all the things that we've been talking about over the last over this conversation, is that book, if you were to ask me, when did I start writing that book about Sartre? Well, I started writing it when I first picked up Oui Clos and started to scratch my head over these very puzzling ideas. So it goes a long way back.
What about other influences? I mean, for me, when I was at university, there were lots of musical and filmic. I mean, I sort of started going to the cinema at the age of about 19 or 20. I'd been before, but it was a family trip, you know, E.T. or Chariots of Fire even, actually. I remember going to see when I was about 8. But choosing to go on my own, it was something that I did much later on, and I kind of felt that I was then going back over all those things that, you know, everybody my age was into Indiana Jones and Ghostbusters, and I wasn't. So I was sort of watching those, and Back to the Future, was watching those, you know, 5 or 10 years later than my peers. But in your case, are there particular radio or music or filmic interests?
Do you know what they are? It's a really simple way of answering your question as well. The influences, if we're talking influences, but those voices who have spoken most profoundly to me were published by Penguin in the orange or the grey stroke brown, I think, I can't really identify the colour, paperback books that I could buy secondhand in a bookshop near my school. And they were generally 49p, because I can still see that 49p written in pencil on the inside cover. And the writers in particular, in addition to Sartre, are Camus, Hermann Hesse, and in particular Steppenwolf, Graham Greene, E.M. Forster, and in particular, one particular text, which is longest short story called The Machine Stops. Orwell, and again, I can say in particular, an extraordinary book, which again really rocked my world, which was a short and a forgotten novel called Keep the Aspidistra Flying, about this extraordinary man called Gordon Comstock, who just wants to abandon the structure of society, but he realises he can't. He's a bit like Winston Smith, but in a slightly different environment.
I remember the film version with Richard E. Grant.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen it before.
Sort of mid-ish 90s.
Oh, okay, I'd like to see that then. And also Aldous Huxley. And some of his slightly weirder novels. And Evelyn Waugh. I've had some problems with Evelyn Waugh, as you probably expect. He speaks from a sort of position which I find a little bit unsettling, especially his support of Francisco Franco, but then everyone has their, you know, political differences. So, if you can picture a range of authors, yes, I confess they're mostly men. I suppose male authors were overrepresented by those second-hand books that I could buy. Although I did read Virginia Woolf, and I can probably think of some other female authors that I would have been reading at the time. Since then, obviously, I've changed my whole library to incorporate many different voices. But at that time, if I had to sort of determine a particular presentation, it was what years later I found had already been codified and written about by Colin Wilson. Colin Wilson, whom some people may know, he's one of a great writers of the paranormal, of the anomalous, of the weird, of strange stuff. But the first thing that he ever published, the thing that gave him a certain leg up in his career at the very beginning, was a book called The Outsider. Now, I only came across this book relatively recently, like 15 years ago. But I realised that what Colin Wilson was writing about was precisely the voice that had spoken to me very clearly as a 15, 16, 17-year-old. And that's a voice that's represented in Harry Haller, the Steppenwolf. It's represented in Gordon Comstock, in Orwell's book, to a certain degree by Winston Smith. It's represented perhaps by the Savage in Brave New World. It's also represented in a book that I read at the same time, although it wasn't a Penguin paperback, called El Túnel, The Tunnel, by an Argentine author called Ernesto Sabato, which we read for GCSE Spanish, or it may have been A-level Spanish. And there is this writer who has that same destructive, and yet at the same time very life-affirming, whilst at the same time suicidal, sort of character. So many of the characters of Graham Greene, these rather cynical, sad, and yet at the same time capable of great passion, characters that you find again and again in what's called Greenland, the world of Graham Greene. So those are the authors, and then I still read all these authors regularly, and I find that was a particular sort of chorus of voices that spoke to me right at the time when I was undergoing all that extraordinary period that everyone goes through from, you know, the ages of 14, 15 through to 17, 18. These were the authors who accompanied me. And I can scarcely mention a film at all. I never watched television, and I scarcely watched any films. There were a number of poets that I read as well, including Coleridge, and as he still speaks to me, and I still read Coleridge regularly. But in terms of great influences, it was definitely those authors. And it's funny that, you know, what was the choice of these authors? The choice of these authors was the change that I had in my pocket, and whether I could actually go and buy this book by Graham Greene. It's at 99p. Do I want to spend the 99p on that, or am I going to buy another pouch of tobacco? What was the priority at the time? There's the long answer to your question.
Now, what I'm getting from this, I don't know what sort of parental influences you had, but it sounds as though, although you've found experientially a lot of the literary influences you have, but what were your parents? Was there an academic history there? Because it sounds as though
no. This
is something that you slotted into very comfortably.
No, but I come from a house full of books. Absolutely full of books. And I now live in a house full of books, although I've done a bit of weeding out recently. And in fact, let me just have an aside there. Something I've just recently understood, and it seems strange that I've reached the age that I've reached and I've now only understood it, but if books are not in circulation and they're not you, then they're worthless. I'm just saying this to anyone listening because it was a revelation that I had only about 2 weeks ago when I was looking through my own book collection thinking, that book I've not read for 20 years and I'm not going to read again. Or that book I've had for 20 years and I've never read it. It's serving no purpose at all aside from gathering dust, and literally gathering dust and taking up space. And I suddenly thought, these books are not serving any purpose unless they're in circulation. And so I did a big weeding out a couple of weeks ago and took a number of books, two suitcases worth of books, to Burgate Books in Canterbury. Other books, I did a little book sale in my front garden, raising money for Porch Night. It was just a sudden understanding that books that you don't read, books that nobody reads, are utterly worthless. So get them in circulation. So that's what I did the other day, and I've been doing the same with some of the books in my office as well, realising that they're probably better placed elsewhere, where at least they're going to be read. Anyway, to go back to your question, I'm struggling to remember what the question was.
Oh, about parental influence, whether you...
My house was always full of books. My parents, where I was born and brought up, full of books. Books everywhere. And it's interesting that I now live in a place full of books. My office is full of books. The university is full of books. My world is full of books. My sister is a publicist for a big London publishing house. Her husband is he runs a literary festival, and he's a reviewer. Their house is full of books. So many of my friends, their houses are full of books. And I now realise that actually the influence is knowing from a very young age that a book is not just entertainment for a couple of hours, but a book is a guide, a book is a teacher, a book is a friend and an antagonist and a provoker and a mechanism by which we learn to come into our own being. And other people find that with music, and I mean, as it is as well with music, it's not that there's one or the other. But I suppose that my world still in books was a world that I was born into.
I remember having this conversation with fellow academic colleagues about digital books and Kindles, which take up a lot less space. I mean, my bookshelves are full of books which, like you, I may or may not ever read, and they're all in, you know, they're not in any order, I just haven't got time to process them. So I read a lot of books on Kindle, but also if I'm watching a film, though, I like to have a hard product, which is odd because streaming is now the thing to do. But I prefer to still go and buy, even though I'm sure I'm spending money that, you know, I could for an annual subscription, which I probably have anyway through Amazon Prime. I'm paying to actually have, like, I, Daniel Blake, I've just started watching. I want to have that copy in my hand. And yet I'll happily read a virtual book. I'm doing things completely back to front. You know, I've got colleagues who will say things like, it's the smell of the books, it's the sense of what it represents, it's the history that's in there, which I think is what you're saying. So it sounds as though, and in a teaching context as well, you know, we can be swayed by the technology. We have to give our lectures now, we have to record our lectures through something called lecture capture. But, you know, I wonder if something is missing through that, whether the technology is helping us or setting us back. It's like politicians are often, you know, is like Gordon Brown was once, you know, said, you know, he's what was it that George Osborne once said? He was an analogue politician in a digital age. But for me, those are existential questions about how we identify ourselves.
I agree with that. Now, okay, let's imagine that you have, you don't work with books in your day-to-day life. You know, it doesn't matter what your profession is, but it's not involving reading books and sharing the experience of that reading with other people. So probably most professions, really. And what you like to read are generally entertaining stories. And of course, you can never stop your learning process, and so you're always learning through your reading, but the prime focus of your reading is to be entertained, which is a very noble pursuit. And in fact, that's if a book doesn't entertain you, then it's actually not worth reading, however important it is philosophically, ethically, whatever it might be. It has to be entertaining. Now, so therefore, your prime focus of reading the books is to be entertained, and you read before going to sleep at night, and you read to, you know, make a long train journey go quickly. Pretty valuable to have a Kindle. It means that, or to have a library. To have a library or a Kindle means the books come into your possession, you read them, and then they leave your possession. You've no need to keep them. You're not going to reread them because you know the storyline. Yes, there might be a passage that you'd like to return to, but I'm sure you can find a way to return to that, but maybe not. In my case, my relationship with books is completely different from that, because I am constantly annotating books. I don't write in the books, but I'm constantly... I generally have a notepad with me whenever I'm reading anything, and I'm generally writing down my thoughts, my reflections, quotes, ideas as I'm reading. In fact, I've got scraps of paper all over the place as I'm reading, and little scraps of paper in the books that I then have to find the time to go and sort of write up with a bit more coherence. I couldn't do that with Kindle. I couldn't do that with reading PDFs on a computer. No, I like to sit in an armchair and hold a book. And not only that, but I like to hold that book repeatedly over the many years. And so I suppose that our whole relationship with books, in the same way that you're talking with films, you could stream a film, spend a nice hour and a half, and then move on. But of course, you work with film. You're paying attention to a degree that just mere entertainment doesn't warrant. You know, you yourself are thinking, will I use this film in a chapter in my next book? Will I be using it in a seminar? Will I be returning to it? Or am I just being entertained for an hour and a half? In which case, stream it. But you're saying you're working in reverse. I don't think that you're doing it back to front. Not at all. I think you're holding on to a very fundamental aspect of the materiality of these cultural forms.
But it's interesting because I've always kept a diary. So if I'm watching something, there has to be a form of demarcating it. There has to be a form of almost assimilating it, writing it down, doing something with it. Otherwise, it is just an empty or transient experience. And I find that recently I've started, because I go to the cinema fairly often, I'm always posting reviews on social media. So it's sort of using social media, but to actually say, I went on my own. I prefer going to the cinema on my own. I choose what I see. I'm not sort of asking somebody else's permission, or, you know, maybe they clash. But I want to share it, that deep need to say, this made an impression on me or not. Or what, you know, and why. So then if somebody then says, oh, on the basis of that, I might give that a try. Didn't look, you know, the review in, you know, Wendy Ide's review on Sunday in The Guardian in The Observer didn't particularly inspire me, but actually, yes, you've gone to see it. I'll trust your wisdom, you know, on this. So for me, I may not annotate in a chair, but, and I might use PDFs, but I'm still annotating them, maybe using electronic means. But for me, there's no point reading something unless there's a sense in which you're engaging with it, which is a form of dissemination, not necessarily publicly. I mean, my diaries, I mean, if I was to publish them, I suspect I'd be ostracized. But in a way, you know, maybe for posterity, maybe nobody will ever read them, but they are there. Everything I do in some way, you know, has a purpose. Otherwise, why do it? Otherwise, the days will just be random and unstructured. And so I think that's a base. I think we may go about it in different ways, but I think that fundamentally we both find that if something is inspiring us, and if it's not inspiring us, why is it not inspiring us? But we are then confronted almost with that sort of need to do something with it and put our own spin on it.
And, absolutely. Yeah. And to try and identify and then articulate the means in which it's meaningful. I'll just give another parallel there. And that is that I still have a record collection of vinyl that I've had for years and years and years. And it's interesting that how different my relationship with that music is from, for example, my kids' relationship with music. They both really, they know about records because I've taught them how to put the records on. They actually understand the concept of a record and an album. But if it weren't for that, they probably wouldn't have. They have a much limited understanding, much more limited understanding than I do, of the notion of an album. What they know is an artist, Ariana Grande, for example, or Beyoncé, or whoever it might be, and the latest song. And they get really inspired by that, and it's wonderful to see. You know, they'll listen to it on YouTube, and they'll ask if they can download it, and they can have it on their MP3 player, and they'll be listening to it. But that comes from a very, very different place from owning a record. It could be on a tape or it could be on a CD as well. It doesn't have to be vinyl, but having what really was marketed, sort of produced and engineered and then created as a specific cultural artifact. Now, I find just the song by itself as an individual, isolated unit with nothing else attached to it, I find that quite a sort of empty experience. Whereas putting on a record and sitting and reading the album sleeve and looking at the artwork and remembering the history of this album, I know it's a little bit sort of, you know, people might mock that, but I find it a very impact. I love it. I find it.
And I still remember those albums. And in the early 80s, I think my sister bought one of the Toya EPs, and there was only a few covers that, you know, had a there was something very distinctive. I forget what it was, or maybe there was a gift inside, or maybe a signature or something. I don't know, from Toya Wilcox herself. But the incentive was to buy the material product from the shop to actually hold it in your hand. Yeah. Whereas now, I went to see about 8 years ago Jersey Boys, and I had a wonderful evening at the theatre. The next day, I was inspired to buy the CD. What an empty experience, because you just had these songs from a show that I didn't go to, that was recorded, perhaps even recorded in the studio rather than on the stage. The song would end, there'd be a pause of 5 or 6 seconds, and then the next one would start. For me, what was amazing about the evening was the experience of it all being held together, watching them on stage, the way that the actors would change the scenery themselves, literally, the scene would end, and then the lights would go down, and you'd see the silhouettes of the actors then moving the tables for the next scene that would go ahead. It was a wonderful choreography. That's what I took from the evening, and that's why I enjoyed it so much. Listening to this inert CD that just went into my car stereo didn't replicate that experience. If anything, it undermined it. And now what I do listen to in my car are old radio programs that I recorded 20, 30 years ago, and often it might be bits of music, but it's the bits in between that once upon a time I thought I'll edit out. It's the presenters' voices. Those presenters in many cases are now dead. But I've got very clear memories of that particular show. I'll hear that small link and I'll think, that was the day I sat that exam, or that was the day I met that person I went out with for the next 5 years. So these are crucial things. And so for me, to somebody else, it might just be, oh, this is very, you know, untidily put together, or what rubbish music. No. For me, the quality of the music is completely irrelevant. That is my life.
Oh, I couldn't
encapsulated
agree more.
You know, in those recordings.
Oh, you see, music, I mean, we haven't talked about music so far. I could spend hours running through those different moments where a different music, rather like I was just talking about all these authors, these different musicians, these different groups, accompany you over a particular period of your life, and then years later, when you listen to that music, that moment of your life with its ups and its downs are brought back in a way, you know, the sort of the Proustian dunking the Madeleine in the linden tea, or was it the chamomile tea, in the tea, and suddenly being transported back. I cultivate that. I absolutely love it. And it could be, for example, I mean, I would have been about 15, 16 when I first heard and became quite obsessed with both The Doors and Led Zeppelin. Now, I still listen to The Doors and I still listen to Led Zeppelin, and I still can recapture that sense of not just joy, but this sort of overwhelming power of the music that I experienced when I was about 15, 16. And in the same way, going to university, my first couple of years at university, I listened and went to see and really, really enjoyed to an ecstatic level Orbital, The Orb, Osric Tentacles, Eat Static, a whole sort of slew of different musicians from the early 1990s, partly associated with that whole sort of rave culture, but also those sort of associated with the being an undergraduate and going on these wild parties that last for 2 days. And I can still put on, for example, one of the early Orbital albums and have that instantaneous transportation to that sense of joy of listening to or seeing and, you know, dancing to Orbital however many years ago. Music has this amazing capacity to transport you. I find it wonderful. And I, like I said, I actually cultivate it. I'll sort of set myself the right, you know, I'll get prepared and then put on an album, knowing that part of putting on that album it is going to be evoking a lot of emotions that have been present with me since those emotions were first sort of consolidated around that music at a particular time in my life. I find that, in the same way I was saying about reading Coleridge, in the same I can find that reading certain poems. You can tap into this state that is permanent. It's a permanent feature of your character, of your being.
And for me to have one of my children when she was at nursery going in and being asked, you know, so what music do you like listening to? And she said, Shake and Stevens. So because, and sort of, it was coming up to Christmas. So actually, I don't even think it was Christmas, for whatever reason, middle of summer, and so Merry Christmas, everyone came on. But I was, you know, that's my childhood, but my children, well, not all of them, some of them are too young to have necessarily views of their own. But to have children in the car recognising songs that are powerful to me, but they get that. They may not like it, but they recognise it, and they're aware, as I am with my own parents, sort of music from the late 50s, early 60s, has a huge existential sort of, you know, appeal. You know, even if it's like transitory stuff like Bobby V or Buddy Holly, but there is something in that. Lonnie Donegan, my dad was a huge Lonnie Donegan fan. He's got all the albums. So for me, growing up with, I don't know, My Old Man's a Dustman, you know, had a huge sort of effect on me growing up, and I'd listen to that because it was my dad's history, and that now has been incorporated into mine, and the two are indistinguishable. So if I was to talk about the music that I grew up with, the influences on me, it's sort of both early 1980s pop, you know, Human League, Bucks Fizz, all that sort of stuff, and at the same time that late 50s stuff, which is his generation, and the two have become completely fused. So listening to inverted commas nostalgia radio programs, for me, it's there's different generational layers of that, but I've assimilated both of them, and if my children, you know, they will hopefully find their own path, but, you know, hopefully they're not going to be completely oblivious anyway to that, because
sure.
it's part of our identity,
and also they're creating their own associations now. And it's funny, I actually deliberately did this. That's to say, we're all creating our associations at every stage. That's obviously the case. Summer holidays, when I was a kid, driving down to Cornwall. I don't know if it happened more than once, but I've certainly got a clear memory of listening to The Beatles 1967 to 1970, that double album. And songs such as Hello, Goodbye, and The Fool on the Hill, and these later Beatles songs. I bought for my daughter when she was quite young, not the sort of age that you generally buy people CDs. She was probably only six, but I bought her the double CD Beatles 1967 to 1970 just before we were driving down to Cornwall for a holiday. And we played it in the car. And I was obviously entering my own sort of Proustian moment, driving down the A303 listening to the Beatles. But I was also thinking, I'm doing it strategically, I'm doing it deliberately, but I'm also now making that same association, but in its different context, for her. And I wonder if, when she's, you know, 20, 30, 40, however many years from now, she might have some memory of listening to I Am the Walrus as you go past Ilminster.
She probably will, but the crucial thing is that the worst thing to do would be, and I don't think you're doing that, would be to enforce that, to say, this is what you should listen to.
No, it's not.
Because one of my daughters resents the fact whenever the Dionne Warwick song Heartbreaker comes on, because I used to play it a lot. And the other one loves it, so she'll go, you know, she'll sing along. The other one says, switch it off, Daddy, I don't like it. And so there are different dynamics there, and it might be to do with the particular, what was going on in my life at the time, that she associates with that, and may not all be very positive. But music for me is very much a benchmark, you know, where I, and it may not be the age of the song in itself, it might be just when I heard it. It might be like the Beatles, obviously that was before both of us were born, but you will associate it now with a particular road trip that you took with your family, and that's going to be, you know, in years to come, you know, that's going to, you know, take on a completely elevated quality, which has got nothing to do with whether the music's worth listening to or not. It's because it's quality proof. It's about a particular time in your life, and it's about what it did to you. And with somebody that says, oh, what a load of rubbish, you know, you say, well, sorry. Yeah, that's my life that has been encapsulated.
You know, this is what we said right at the beginning. I mean, what I said, you know, in terms of there's no objective quality at all. You know, there's no such thing as good music or bad music. There's music that you want or don't want to listen to. There's music that makes you feel that you are enjoying the experience or not. I mean, it's... I mean, and again, in terms of nostalgia, just another sort of thought about this as we're talking about music is, I don't know if this is something that you've experienced, but when there is an association that is very powerful with, for example, a particular piece of music, there are a couple of examples where I'm actually very keen to not to... lessen its power by overplaying. And I'll give you two examples of this. I won't give the whole story, but one is the album Disintegration by The Cure, and the other is the double album, which the first, Aphex Twin's Selected Ambient Works, Volume 1 and 2. Both the Aphex Twin and The Cure, I listen to with such intensity at a particular time, different times, but to particular times in my life, with such amazing emotional intensity that I can still recapture that. And it's beautiful, if a little frightening sometimes. Now, that means that I'll happily play all sorts of records. I'll happily play this, happily play that. My kids, for example, rummaging through my record collection. Oh, let's put on Grace Jones again. Yeah, let's put on Jean-Michel Jarre again. Yeah, let's put on... Neil Young again. Yeah, let's put on Disintegration. No, can we not? Do you mind if we don't? Let's put on Aphex Twin. No, because this is something that I know that it'll by putting it on, it'll evoke such astonishingly powerful emotional response in me that I love. It's not that it's that I don't want it, but it's that I want to have it only at the right time, when it's now going to be able to do its magic. And so I want to sort of keep that magic, keep it pristine, keep it bottled up in a funny sort of way, so that I can unbottle it at those appropriate moments. And I don't know if you know what I'm talking about there. There might be music that you'd rather somebody didn't play. You'd rather not listen to.
Well, more than that, because I associate music with particular times in my life. Am I thinking of the first time I heard that, or the time that I recorded it, Or, you know, if I then hear that particular tape that I did 25 years ago now, am I going to be remembering that experience rather than the ones that I've accumulated over the years? And, of course, you could end up sullying a really good experience.
By overlaying it with new memories.
But luckily I find that there is something about, there's almost an original core, which I find that I can return to.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky that I can do that, because otherwise I will associate particular recordings that I've made with periods in my life that may not be quite as happy as perhaps the original ones when they were recorded. So there are lots of layers in that, but there is a core essence, which I find that now, even going back to programmes that I first heard 20 or 30 years ago. And sometimes I can still see why I was connected to those radio shows from 30 years ago. I listen now and think, yeah, you know, if I was listening to that now, I would still find that as appetizing, as enthralling as I did then. There's a certain consistency, I think, in me, you know, as you get older, that there's a sense of that there's a core me, which I may have aged over the years, but in the same way that when you go back to, say, a reunion, what you don't want to find is all those people that you connected with, you no longer have anything in common with. For me, I know that I'm the same person who could pick up the same conversations from then, and I hope they have as well. And it's the fear maybe that maybe they have moved on in a different way that makes me less inclined to go back, in case I then find that maybe I've been putting them on a pedestal all these years.
I think
it's the same with music.
I think that's the same. That's kind of what I was moving towards in that idea. That yeah, that there are some, there are these this emotional association that you want to, you don't want to sort of dilute, as it were, by overlaying it with lots of new times.
But I do think that if something is that powerful for you, then wherever you hear it, whatever context it's in, it's still there.
And it
does actually still sometimes prop me up emotionally.
Absolutely.
It elevates me.
Yeah.
I've got one more question for you, which is, would you call yourself a looking back sort of person or a looking forward sort of person?
I make a point of never responding to a binary question with one answer or the other.
Indeed. Well, of course, that was why I asked the question, because if you'd asked me that question, I would have really struggled. Because, I mean, that is my research, in a nutshell, the religious or the secular. It's the two. It's the religious through the secular, the secular through the religious. But what I was really getting at here is not a yes-no answer, so much as simply saying, are you somebody who finds that the past is somewhere where you kind of want to go back to, you want to re-explore, maybe rebuild some of those memories, go back on that road that you went on and listen to the Beatles? Or is there a sense in which moving forward in a direction that means that, yeah, maybe some of those past experiences, those past memories, are a vital part of who you are, but you kind of don't look back, that actually moving forward is necessary, because otherwise you're going to find yourself beholden to a particular narrative that you feel you're no longer comfortable with? And I think, the reason I ask that question is because I was once told in a counselling context that I'm someone who likes a consistency of narrative. So for me, if somebody ever says something to me, it could be in a relationship, that on one day is different to what they say on another, or if somebody sort of sets up this narrative, I want to be with you forever and ever, then afterwards they have a different, you know, they change their mind. Changing your mind is absolutely fine, but of course if you take somebody with you on this journey, or if a politician suddenly ends up changing their narrative, then suddenly you think, well, hang on a minute,
like Theresa May on Brexit.
Although whether she was beholden to Brexit in the first, you know, the to remain in the first place, I mean, she was not exactly an overly enthusiastic Remainer. But then, you know, but that is the issue with Theresa May, and it's often been said that in an age now where we look for those inverted commas authentic stroke eccentric, the two are synonymous politicians, whether it's Jacob Rees-Mogg or Boris Johnson or Donald Trump, someone like Theresa May is more of a Sphinx type figure, that, you know, she kind of, it's hard to know what's going on there. She is the sort of politician who 10, 20 years ago, I think, you know, would obviously have, you know, stepped into the role that she's doing now. She's kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time, I would say. But my sort of question was more along the lines of To what extent do you carry the, and I was going to say baggage, but maybe that's not the right word, but to what extent does a lot of what you've been up to in the past, your past experiences, your past memories, do they, are they part of this wider trajectory that you can carry with you into the future and feel that there's this holistic sense of identity? Or is it more the case, as some of you say, that was a good experience, I need to move on, I have a journey that I need to take, and sometimes I need to extricate myself, like the books that you were talking about earlier that you feel that you're not going to read again, that you do away with?
Yes.
Yeah. I like the fact that my last question is one where my question took about 10 times longer to also, ask than you did to answer.
I'll end with a little comment here. I've been exploring for a number of years the meaning of a particular term, and in fact I've used it in the title of one of my books, and the word is imaginal. And if I had to give a succinct description of what the word imaginal means, I can be quite facetious, but it's also quite meaningful, and that is, it's the answer to a question, is it A or is it B, with yes. Right? I find this, it screws with our entire Aristotelian logical circuitry, and that is, no, it has to be A or B. What is it? Is it A or B? And if my answer is yes, if you can handle that, I mean, I don't mean you personally, Chris, but I mean, if you can handle the answer, is it A or B? Yes. If you can handle that answer, then you understand the maybe logic, as Robert Anton Wilson would call it, the maybe logic of the imaginal. So you've presented a question. Do I consider the past and memories to be a sort of trajectory that leads us into the future? Or is it something that's in the past and the future is isolated? Well, the answer is, why is it one or the other? And the answer is, it depends on the day, depends on what I'm doing, depends on whether I'm writing ideas for a future project or whether I'm digging through archives to try and recover something, whether I'm spending an evening happily sinking into a glass of red wine and some very old photographs that are still hard copies rather than digital photographs, or whether I'm throwing things away to try and move forward. You know, it depends on the time. Depends on the time of day and night and everything.
You've given the most brilliant answer, because you've exposed what is at the heart of my, certainly the core of the research that I've been doing in recent years, which is the problem with binaries. The idea that things, even for the same person, it's never one or the other, but people make out to be, because it's great to deal with those great sort of simplistic binaries that often in my field, in the study of religion, come out all the time. Is it religious? Is it, you know, is it good or is it
Chris,
bad?
Chris, can I interrupt you there? I can't bear binaries of this nature. They really piss me off. Because again and again and again and again, you find people are presented with a binary that they have to make a decision. And I can never see a simple oppositionality within that. And you could not get a better example than this ridiculous referendum of June 2016. An incredibly complex system of all involving so many different aspects of society, politics, trade, geography, finance, culture, people, blah 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 blah. This incredibly complex thing reduced to in or out. Oh, what a ridiculous situation. What an absolutely ridiculous situation. And you see that represented so many places, the idea of, well, what is it? You know, a typical one, that you've identified it yourself in terms of religious studies, secular or sacred, or religious or secular, religious or secular, sacred or profane. Well, I can't bear such a binary. I have spent quite a long time working to a certain degree within the cultures of Afro-Cuban religious syncretic form. Santeria, for example. Some of these matters I talk about in the teaching. There's no distinction between the sacred and the profane. Playing the drums is a sacred act. Whether you're gathering as a group of people and you're drinking rum and smoking lots of cigarettes and just, you know, having a laugh, or whether it's a more focused ceremony with a particular attention to a particular santo or a particular spirit. Anyone would laugh at you. You said, well, if you were to put your hand up and say, excuse me, is what you're doing sacred or profane? They'd say, shut up and have a drink. You know, what a stupid question. Get on with it. There is no distinction. And of course, I think we're slightly encultured within that. You know, the profane day is a Monday to Saturday, and then the sacred day is Sunday. The ancestors are only with you under certain circumstances. The saints are only contactable on those particular saints' days. Whatever it is, no. In this respect, in terms of sacred and profane, I cannot see that distinction at all.
I find filling in the census impossible because I want to tick more than one box. The issue about are you religious, and if so, what is your religious affiliation? And you look at the list and you say, well, I don't really think that any of those quite fit. And yet, certainly in terms of my profession, I feel that at least one of them should. Or I know one friend who once said that she wanted to tick both Christian and Muslim at the same time. She didn't want to, absolutely, but I don't think the form allowed her to do that. But I remember once being in Swansea in around 1999, and I was stopped in the street to do one of these stupid surveys, which was effectively, it was the question was sort of, are you a beer drinker or a wine drinker? And I think,
and the answer is yes.
Well, yes. The answer was, sometimes I like beer, sometimes I like wine, but I could only give one answer.
Oh, so
this is what happened. So I said beer. Then the next question was something along the lines of, what sort of wine do you like? Whatever.
But you're not allowed to answer that if you've answered beer.
But this is the crucial thing. The problem was, because they only accepted these binary answers, that one of the questions absurdly was, I say I've identified myself as a beer drinker, that it was, what is it about wine that you don't like? I said, no, I like wine very much. Oh, so is it, you know, and they were giving me these answers and I had to choose which one was right. Anyway, it was a stupid survey because I was giving disingenuous answers because the questions were disingenuous. And then, some months later, I remember on the radio, there was a story, it was like the last item in the 3-minute news bulletin, which was all about this survey, which was looking at people's drinking trends. And immediately, 72% of people prefer beer over wine. And I thought, I was part of that survey. That survey is completely bollocks. Yeah. There we are. So you're right. Brexit, the referendum, even with elections sometimes.
Absolutely, not sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that we generally are always voting for Labour or Tory. Labour or Tory. Yes, you can. There are other parties, and there is other representation, as there was with the coalition. But generally, it's the House of Commons is built along these two opposing sides. It's built with this idea of now the opposition. You know, it's time for the opposition to do whatever the opposition is going to do. Opposing. It seems to me ridiculous that we should have a system that is designed around oppositionality. That's to say, it's designed, the actual mechanism of running the country is designed around conflict. I can't bear that. I think that's why people become ideological. Ideologies are dangerous. Ideologies do not allow an alternative narrative. That's why they're ideologies. And in order to become a conservative politician, especially if you're going to be in the cabinet, you have to have abandoned all subtlety and to have become an ideologue, in the same way that if you were to become a cabinet under Tony Blair's New Labour, you have to become an ideologue. It's ridiculous. Nuance, subtlety, working together, a sense of pooling resources as opposed to always opposing resources, ideas, is, I think, very destructive. And I think this is a problem that we've got at the heart of our governance. And I really do feel that. I think that Parliament was designed that way centuries ago, and it was designed around the idea that the best outcomes for any debate about legislation is through opposition. I don't agree with that. I think that there are many things that you'll find people are quite willing to work together with if they didn't have to represent this ridiculous party ideological division.
Yeah.
That's
Yeah.
And I find in a teaching context, the idea that we would pit our students against each other, or if we were having a staff meeting, the idea that we would all sort of take adversarial positions. Sometimes people do that organically, but
well, it's healthy when it happens.
But that's because it happens naturally. But in the House of Commons, I mean, how many prime ministers or leaders of the opposition have said that they want prime minister's questions to be less adversarial? Cameron said that. Blair said that, but they all, you know, went into the typical adversarial mode because that the tribal mode because that's the way that the House of Commons is set up. When you watch Prime Minister's questions, you've got the Speaker having to always, you know, tell everyone to pipe down. You think, but you know, these are the people who are representing us; they are policymakers. And yet, if we, in our jobs with our students, were to always be at each other's throats, it would look completely uncivilized. It would look unprofessional. So, right, so there is something about that setup which doesn't fit. Although that said, it is wonderful. Spectacle. I think Bruce Forsyth always used to say that he used to find that there was something in PMQs that was, you know, in a way that what made comedy work, that sense of two people at each other, and you sort of sometimes felt the passion, the drama, and that it wasn't perhaps an unintentional sort of, you know,
no, I think it's intentional because it's theatre. Otherwise, why would they televise it and why would anyone watch it? It is theatre, and it's born slightly out of the Oxford and Cambridge debating societies where, again, what makes somebody a good debater is that they can be given a narrative, they can be given a particular angle. There's no expectation that this is what they believe. Okay, so I want you now to advocate euthanasia, or I want you to advocate, I want you now to put forth your arguments as to why homosexuality is wrong. Okay, I don't care what you believe, give me that, you know, that's your role now. And if you can do a good job in that role as an advocate of a particular position that you don't actually believe in, then you are doing brilliantly. You know, you've taken on those skills, that amazingly complex skill set of being able to argue a position that's not your own. Now, if you actually look at most of the members of the cabinet, you'll realise that that is precisely what they excel at. What they excel at is arguing a position and arguing it with great tenacity and doing it very, very effectively. I think Boris Johnson is very good at that. I think he does a great job at having a line and arguing it and arguing, doing so very coherently and very compellingly and twisting the other person's position until they're floundering like a fish out of water. But unfortunately, going back to the conversation that we've been having all this last hour, is it doesn't really connect with any deeper moral, ethical, human motivation. It's a game, it's a theatre, it's a pantomime. And they're very good at it, but it's not, to me, genuine. It's not, to me, authentic.
Yeah, I had that struggle. I was 16 years of age, and in school, in the debating society, I was asked if I would make a case for the poll tax. And I went to the teacher and said, I can't do it because it's wrong. And she said, well, that's fine, but she said there are people who advocate it, so you just need to, you know, get yourself into their mindset. And of course, she was right, but sometimes there's that sense that there are principles, but we defend our principles, but it seems disingenuous sometimes to argue something we don't believe in. I fudged it in the end. I made the case for the poll tax, but I ended up sort of inadvertently saying, but of course the better system would be something more, you know, income tax based. And there were people who really were Tories in the school who thought that the poll tax was wonderful, and I was supposed to be on their side, but I ended up sort of subtly trying to sort of say, well, I'm making the case for the poll tax, but there are alternatives out there. And of course, in a way, I was sort of having my cake and eating it too. But yeah, I quite agree.
No, it's a great skill. I mean, it's a very useful skill, a very necessary skill to be able not only to understand another person's position or another position and to argue it. That's a great skill, and it can, you know, it can serve you very well. But I don't think it's one to be sort of the modus operandi of one's whole life. And of course, there are many people, especially if they end up in the cabinet, who that's precisely their position, you know, and that is their modus operandi for their day-to-day job. I think that's very sad.
Yeah. William Rowlandson. This has been an interview that's gone on about half an hour longer than I was expecting, but I kind of feel there are still questions I haven't even asked. So we're going to have to do this maybe in 10 years' time. We'll have a nostalgia interview in which we rake over our first discussion of nostalgia and see, and you know, and maybe we'll still be exiting the European Union. Who knows? Maybe the world will have ended by then. So
who knows?
We know we may or may not return to
it. Yeah, I've enjoyed this conversation, Chris.
Thank you very much.